Human capital. Physical wealth may be highly visible, but human capital, invisible inside people's heads, is often more crucial to the long-run prosperity of a nation or a people. John Stuart Mill used this fact to explain why nations often recover with surprising speed from the physical devastations of war. What the enemy have destroyed would have been destroyed in a little time by the inhabitants themselves, in the normal course of their consumption, and would require replenishing. Given the wear and tear on capital equipment, constant reproduction of new equipment would likewise be required. What the war does not destroy is the human capital that created the physical capital in the first place. Even the massive physical devastations of World War II, from bombings and widely destructive ground battles, were followed by a rapid economic recovery in post-war Western Europe. Aid from the United States under the Marshall Plan has often been credited with this recovery, but the later sending of foreign aid to many third world countries produced no such dramatic economic growth. The difference is that industrialized Western Europe had already developed the human capital which had produced modern industrial societies there before the war began, but third world countries had yet to develop that human capital, without which the physical capital was often of little or no use when it was donated as foreign aid. The Marshall Plan eased the transition to peacetime economic recovery in Western Europe, but foreign aid could not create the necessary scale of human capital where that human capital did not already exist. Confiscations of physical capital have likewise seldom produced any major or lasting enrichment of those who do the confiscating, whether these are third world governments confiscating, nationalizing, foreign investments, or urban rioters looting stores in their neighborhoods. What they cannot confiscate is the human capital that created the physical things that are taken. However serious the losses suffered by those who have been robbed, whether by governments or by mobs, the physical things have a limited duration. Without the human capital required to create their replacements, the robbers are unlikely to prosper in future years as well as those who were robbed. Human capital may also play a role in the fact that has often been pointed out that many of the poorest societies have been located in the tropics, and many of the most prosperous have been located in temperate zones. Yet many peoples from temperate zones who have gone to live in the tropics have often prospered there, as the Chinese have in Malaysia and the Lebanese have in West Africa, far more so than people indigenous to those regions. Here, as elsewhere, the effects of a particular geographic setting can be both direct and indirect, presenting objective opportunities and either extending or restricting the development of the human capital necessary to make the most of those opportunities. Sometimes the very advantages of a given geographic setting can make it unnecessary for the people indigenous in that setting to have to develop their human capital to the fullest. For example, a tropical land capable of producing crops the year round can make it unnecessary for the people there to develop the same sense of urgency about time and the resulting habits of economic self-discipline that are necessary for sheer physical survival in a climate where people must begin plowing the land soon after it thaws in the spring if they are to raise a crop during the limited growing season in the temperate zone that will enable them to feed themselves throughout the long winter months. This was especially so during the millennia before modern transportation made it economically feasible to draw vast amounts of food from other lands around the world. The unavoidable necessity of storing food to live on during the winter means that, for centuries, ingrained habits of saving were also essential for survival among peoples in the temperate zones. But in the tropics, the development of such habits is by no means always so urgent. Moreover, the ability to store grain or potatoes to eat during the winter is much greater in temperate climates than the ability to store bananas, pineapples, or other tropical foods in hot climates. Human capital includes not only information, but habits, and the habits necessary for survival in some geographic settings are by no means the same as in other geographic settings. Like many other things, natural abundance can have both positive and negative effects. The saying among the Thais, "rice on the land and fish in the water," expressed a confidence in the abundance of nature that was foreign to people struggling to survive in the very different geographic setting of southern China, where hunger and starvation were perils for centuries, forcing the people there to become frugal, hard-working, and resourceful under threat of extinction. When people from southern China migrated into more promising geographic environments in Thailand, Malaysia, or the United States, these qualities, these habits, this human capital, enabled them to thrive, even when they began as destitute immigrants and later became more prosperous than the people who were living in the same environment before them. Much the same story could be told of the Lebanese, the Jews, and others who arrived in many places around the world as immigrants with very little money, but with much human capital that they had developed in other, more challenging settings. Many other groups have had similar patterns as migrants within their own countries. Conspicuous among advanced groups are some whose home region is infertile and overpopulated. The Tamils of Sri Lanka, the Bamileke of Cameroon, the Kabyle Berbers of Algeria, the Kikuyu of Kenya, the Toba Batak of Indonesia, the Ilocano of the Philippines, the Malaalis of Kerala in India, and the Igbo of Nigeria all come from regions too poor to support their populations, and all have unusually high rates of migration to areas outside their home regions, where they have taken up a variety of opportunities in the modern sector. The era of European colonialism put Western education and Western industrial, commercial, and administrative skills within reach for groups previously among the poorer indigenous peoples such as the Igbos in Nigeria and the Tamils in Sri Lanka, who then rose to become more prosperous than others who had been more prosperous before. The resentments of their rise and the politicized polarizations that followed led to bloody civil wars in both countries. Cultural isolation. One of the aspects of a culture that can be very important in its economic consequences is a willingness or unwillingness to learn from other cultures. This can vary greatly from one culture to another. Both Britain and Japan, for example, rose from being island nations lagging economically for centuries behind their respective continental neighbors before eventually catching up and then surging ahead of them, largely as a result of absorbing the cultural and economic advances of other nations and then carrying these advances further themselves. The otherwise very different cultures of Britain and Japan were alike in their receptivity to incorporating features of other cultures into their own. This receptivity to advances made elsewhere is at least part of the answer to a question about Britain posed by an Italian scholar. How, in the first place, did a peripheral island rise from primitive squalor to world domination? By way of contrast, the Arab Middle East, once a culture more advanced than that in Europe, became resistant to learning from others, lost its lead, and then fell behind other nations that were advancing faster. In today's Arab world, about 300 million people in 22 countries, the number of books translated from other languages has been just one-fifth of the number translated by Greece alone, for a population of 11 million. A United Nations study showed that the number of books translated in the Arab world during a five-year period was less than one book for every million Arabs, while in Hungary there were 519 books translated for every million people, and in Spain, 920 books per million people. Put differently, Spain translates as many books into Spanish annually as the Arabs have translated into Arabic in 1,000 years. Cultural isolation can be a factor in wealth differences among nations, just as geographic isolation can be. While highly educated people in the Arab world may not require translations to be able to understand what is written in other languages, the same is not true for the less fortunate masses of people. Since many of the elites in Arab countries speak English or other languages, these elites have access to a vastly larger cultural universe than the masses. The absence of translated writings would therefore tend to increase the economic and other inequalities within these countries, as well as increase the economic inequalities between these countries and the Western world. Sometimes cultural isolation has been the result of a government decision, as in 15th century China, when that country was far more advanced than many other nations. China's rulers deliberately chose to isolate China from what they saw as foreign barbarians. In the 17th century, the rulers of Japan likewise chose to isolate their country from the rest of the world. In later centuries, Both countries were shocked to discover that some other nations had far surpassed them technologically, economically, and militarily during their self-imposed isolation. Among the other ways in which cultures handicap themselves is in limiting which segments of their populations are allowed to play which roles in the economy or society. If only people from certain pre-selected groups, whether defined by class, caste, tribe, race, religion, or sex, are allowed to have particular careers, this cultural distribution of economic roles can differ greatly from the individual distribution of inborn talents. The net result can be that by forfeiting the potentialities of many of its own people, such a society ends up with a less productive economy than in other societies without such self-imposed restrictions on the development and use of their people's talents and potentialities. History is full of examples of societies whose cultural norms confined particular segments of their population to particular roles, or even drove some of their most productive groups out of the country because the prosperity of those groups made them targets of resentments that resulted in persecution, mob violence, or outright expulsions. Other societies whose cultures were less restrictive or repressive often benefited economically from the arrival of refugees with valuable skills and talents, even if these refugees had little money with them when they arrived. 17th century England, for example, benefited from the arrival of tens of thousands of Huguenots fleeing persecution in France. Huguenots created the watch industry in London, as other refugees created other enterprises and industries in Britain. Similarly, Spain's mass expulsions of Jews in 1492, forcing them to leave most of their wealth behind, led many to settle in Holland, where the human capital that they retained helped make themselves prosperous again, and helped make Amsterdam one of the world's great commercial ports. Over the centuries, tens of millions of people fled from various parts of Europe to the United States, whether to escape persecution or just to seek wider economic opportunities than were available to ordinary people in Europe. Many American industries were created or greatly advanced by immigrants who had been people of no real wealth or distinction in Europe, but who became economic titans in America, while transforming the United States from a predominantly agricultural country into the leading industrial nation of the world. Cultural isolation takes many forms, creating economic and other handicaps that differ from group to group and from one society, nation, or civilization to another. Differing levels of cultural isolation within and between societies add to geographic and other factors, making economic equality unlikely among groups, societies, nations, or civilizations. Cultural development. Because not all cultures developed written versions of their languages at the same time, there has been vastly larger and more varied written knowledge available in one language than in another language at a particular period of history. Thus, in the 19th century, Czechs, Estonians, or Latvians who wanted to become doctors or scientists, or to work in other professions that required advanced education, could more readily find the appropriate books and courses available in the German language than in their own languages. Although there was a written version of the indigenous language in Estonia before the 19th century, most of the publications in the Estonian language remained religiously oriented before 1850, and the working language of all educated persons was German. Educated people in adjoining Latvia and in the Habsburg Empire's province of Bohemia, among other places in Eastern Europe and the Baltic, were likewise educated in German. German was the language of the educated classes in Prague, whether those educated individuals were ethnically German, Czech, or Jewish. Similarly, in the Baltic port city of Riga in the Russian Empire, most of the education in that city in the 19th century was conducted in German, even though Germans were no more than one-fourth of the city's population. When the Tsarist government opened a university in Estonia in 1802, most of its faculty and students were German, and this remained so for most of the 19th century. It was not just in formal education, but also in many different craft skills, that Germans were more advanced than many of the peoples of Eastern Europe. German farm settlements along the Volga and in the Black Sea region of the Russian Empire were more productive and more prosperous than the farms of the indigenous population. There was a history behind such patterns. As already noted, Western European languages developed written versions centuries before Eastern European languages as a result of Western Europe's having been conquered by the Romans and having acquired Latin letters. During the Middle Ages, it was not uncommon for Western Europeans to be a majority of the population in various Eastern European cities. These urban Western Europeans were often Germans, though there were some Jews and other Western Europeans as well. Even when the Germans were not a majority of the urban inhabitants, they were often a majority of the economic elites, as in Prague in the Habsburg Empire, or in Riga, Tallinn, and other Baltic cities in the Russian Empire. While Slavs were usually an overwhelming majority of the people in the Eastern European countrysides, there were also enclaves of German farming communities in Eastern Europe, often deliberately recruited by Eastern European rulers, who were anxious to bring people with more advanced skills into their domains, so as to increase the wealth and power of the lands they ruled. Not only did this transplant more advanced knowledge, technology, and experience into Eastern Europe, it also opened the possibility of indigenous individuals in Eastern Europe acquiring some of the cultural advances from Western Europe. From a purely economic standpoint, these infusions of human capital into Eastern Europe contributed to greater opportunities for members of the indigenous population to advance economically by rising, as many did, through the acquisition of the German language and culture. However, from a social and political standpoint, a situation in which the German minority dominated the business and professional elites, when German families in Prague often had Czech servants, but few, if any, Germans were servants, was a situation provoking ethnic resentments, and eventually ethnic identity movements expressing those resentments politically. Similar tensions and polarizations have been common in other countries, where an immigrant group brought more human capital than that of the indigenous population and was conspicuously more prosperous as a result. The Chinese in Southeast Asia, Lebanese in West Africa, Japanese in Peru, and Indians in Fiji, among many others. Within nations as well, particular groups have migrated from one part of their country to another, bringing economic benefits while provoking social and political backlashes because of others' resentments of their higher economic achievements. However these conflicts turned out, and some have turned out tragically, from a purely economic standpoint, these are among the many complicating factors which prevent regions, races, and nations from having either equal outcomes or even the same pattern of inequalities over time. Leaders and spokesmen for lagging groups have often tended to blame others for their lags, sometimes depicting qualification standards for admissions to educational institutions or for employment as arbitrary barriers. This view was epitomized by an ethnic spokesman in India who asked, "Are we not entitled to jobs just because we are not as qualified?" and by an ethnic spokesman in Nigeria who decried the tyranny of skills. Very similar political responses to achievement differences have been common in other countries, with the German minority being blamed for the lags of Czechs in 19th century Bohemia or Latvians in Latvia, just as Fijians in Fiji blamed the Indian minority there, and the peoples of various countries in Southeast Asia tended to blame the Chinese minority there. In other words, ethnic leaders have often turned their people against the cultures that could help advance them, and dissipated their energies in opposing both such cultures and the people who had the advantages of those cultures. These were not necessarily irrational actions on the part of ethnic leaders, whose promotion of an us-against-them attitude advanced the ethnic leaders' careers, even when it was detrimental to the economic interests of the people they led. This pattern has been common at various times and places on every inhabited continent. It was the exception, rather than the rule, when the great philosopher David Hume urged his fellow 18th-century Scots to learn the English language for the sake of their own advancement, which they did, and rose rapidly in many fields. Ultimately, the Scots surpassed the English in engineering and medicine. That too was the exception, rather than the rule. The 19th-century Japanese were another exception. Once their isolation was ended, the Japanese openly acknowledged their long lag behind Western nations and proceeded to bring in experts from Europe and America to introduce Western technology into Japan. In the 20th century, Japan caught up to the West in many areas and surpassed the West in others. But as of the time when Commodore Perry's American naval forces pressured the Japanese government to open their country to the outside world in 1853, the backwardness of the Japanese was demonstrated in their reaction to a train that Perry presented as a gift. At first, the Japanese watched the train fearfully from a safe distance, and when the engine began to move, they uttered cries of astonishment and drew in their breath. Before long, they were inspecting it closely, stroking it, and riding on it, and they kept this up throughout the day. Yet from such levels of technological backwardness, Japan began a massive importation of European and American technology and engineers, and a widespread learning of the English language to directly acquaint themselves with the science and technology of the West. Slowly at first, but more rapidly as they acquired more experience, the Japanese rose in the following century to the forefront of world technology in many fields, producing trains that surpassed any produced in the United States. As a country with a population almost entirely of one race, and with no history of being a conquered people before 1945, there was little basis on which 19th century Japan could blame others for their lags. Nor did they or their leaders attempt to do so. But again, Scotland and Japan were rare exceptions, and so was their spectacular rise to economic success. Both countries had meager natural resources and were in previous centuries poor and backward. Neither had the same geographic prerequisites for originating an industrial revolution as some other countries did, but the fact that both acquired knowledge of the advances already made by other people who lived in more fortunate environments enabled them to transcend the geographic handicaps of their own environment and move to the forefront of human achievement. Because nations that are culturally and economically more advanced are not necessarily more advanced militarily as well, their prosperity and the culture that created it can be destroyed by militarily more powerful peoples who may not be as advanced otherwise. When invading barbarians destroyed the Roman Empire, they destroyed most of the institutions that had perpetuated Roman culture, leaving the peoples of the former Roman Empire, both economically and technologically, living below the level their forebears had achieved under Roman rule. Artifacts from medieval Europe reveal that the quality of their workmanship had declined significantly since the days of the Roman Empire. Central heating, which was introduced into Britain in Roman times, became rare or non-existent, even among the nobility, in the centuries after the Romans withdrew. Medieval cities in Europe, including Rome itself, had much smaller populations and fewer amenities than in Roman times. As late as the early 19th century, no European city had as dependable a water supply as many Roman cities once had, more than 1,000 years earlier. History does not always move in an upward line of progress. Sometimes the retrogressions can be deep and long-lasting. Population. Populations can affect economic outcomes by their size, their demographic characteristics, or their mobility, among other factors. The concentration or dispersion of a population can also greatly affect economic progress, which often varies with the degree of urbanization. Either the physical or the social separation of different segments of a country's population can also affect the extent of their cooperation and coordination in economic activities. Population size. The danger of overpopulation has long been a recurrent concern. Even before Malthus raised his historic alarm at the end of the 18th century, that the number of human beings threatened to exceed the number for which there was an adequate food supply. At various places and times throughout history, famines have been monumental tragedies that some have regarded as confirmation of Malthus's theory. As late as the 20th century, a famine in the Soviet Union under Stalin took millions of lives, and in China under Mao, tens of millions. But even catastrophes of this almost unimaginable magnitude do not prove that the world's food supply is inadequate to feed the world's population. Famines in particular countries or regions are often due to factors at work in those particular countries and regions at the time, such as a local crop failure or the disruption of transportation due to war, weather, or other causes. In the case of the Soviet Union, the famine was concentrated in a region, the Ukraine, that was before and is again today a major producer and exporter of wheat. Crop failures are not sufficient by themselves to bring on famine, unless food from other parts of the world cannot reach the stricken areas in time, and on a scale sufficient to head off mass starvation or the diseases to which undernourished people become vulnerable. Poor countries lacking transportation networks capable of moving vast amounts of food in a short time have been especially susceptible to famines. The modern transportation revolution has reduced such conditions over most of the world, but a country or region isolated for political reasons can remain susceptible to famine, as in the Soviet Union under Stalin and China under Mao. After radical changes in China's economic system in the decades following the death of Mao, an estimated one-fourth of China's adults were overweight by the early 21st century. Contrary to Malthusian theory, few, if any, countries have had a higher standard of living when their population was half of what it is today. Studies based on empirical evidence show results very different from those projected by advocates of overpopulation theories. For example, between the 1890s and 1930s, the sparsely populated area of Malaysia, with hamlets and fishing villages, was transformed into a country with large cities, extensive agricultural and mining operations, and extensive commerce. The population rose from about 1.5 to about 6 million. The much larger population had much higher material standards and lived longer than the small population of the 1890s. Since the 1950s, rapid population increase in densely populated Hong Kong and Singapore has been accompanied by large increases in real income and wages. The population of the Western world has more than quadrupled since the middle of the 18th century. Real income per head is estimated to have increased by a factor of 5 or more. Nevertheless, overpopulation theories of poverty have endured and have had sporadic resurgences in the media and in politics, much like theories that we are running out of various natural resources. Moreover, the arguments are similar in both cases. The indisputable fact that there are finite limits to the amount of each natural resource has led to the non sequitur that we are nearing those limits. Similarly, the indisputable fact that there are finite limits to the number of people that the planet can feed has led to the non sequitur that we are nearing those limits. Poverty and famine in various parts of the world have been taken as evidence of overpopulation, but poverty and famine have been far more common in such thinly populated regions as sub-Saharan Africa than in densely populated Western Europe or Japan, which have several times as many people per square mile as in sub-Saharan Africa. Travelers in Eastern Europe during the Middle Ages often commented on the large amount of land that was unused in this poor part of Europe. While today there are densely populated poor countries like Bangladesh, there are also sparsely populated poor countries like Guyana, whose population density is the same as that of Canada, which has several times as large an output per capita and one of the highest standards of living in the world. In short, neither high population density nor low population density automatically makes a country rich or poor. What seems to matter more is not the number of people, but the productivity of those people, which is dependent on many factors, including their own habits, skills, and experience. To the extent that population density, as in urban communities, can facilitate the development of human capital, people in small isolated societies have tended to lag behind the general progress of others. Population movements. While peoples in different regions of the world might live, and their cultures and societies evolve, in their own respective regions for millennia, at various times they have also moved to other regions of the world, whether as conquerors, immigrants, or slaves. Some have migrated singly or in families, and others have migrated en masse, whether settling among existing inhabitants or driving the existing inhabitants out and displacing them, as invaders from Asia in centuries past set off chain reactions of population displacements in Eastern Europe and the Balkans, or as invaders from Europe would later displace indigenous populations in North America. In the early years of the Industrial Revolution, when technology advanced through the direct practical work of people in factories, mines, and other productive facilities, rather than through the application of science as in later times, the movement of migrants was the principal means of diffusion of technology from its sources to other nations and regions. Thus, British technological advances could spread more readily to an English-speaking country like the United States than to nearer countries on the continent of Europe. The government of Britain, where the Industrial Revolution began, tried to restrict the movement of British workers to other countries in order to protect Britain's technological advantages. However, as technological advances became more and more a matter of applying science, knowledge could more readily be spread on paper, rather than requiring the actual movement of people. Improvements in transportation and communications during the 19th century also sped up the diffusion of technological advances. By 1914, British advances in technology had spread not only to nearby countries, but across the continent of Europe. In countries around the world, the movement of peoples is also a movement of their cultures. This can result in a displacement of existing cultures at their destination, a planting of a new culture in the midst of one already in place, or an assimilation to the destination culture by the migrants. These varied prospects add more combinations and permutations to the possibilities affecting economic and social development, making equal development among regions, races, and nations even less likely than with geographic or cultural differences alone. Sometimes the newcomers end up adopting the culture of the surrounding society, beginning with the language, as most of the millions of immigrants to the United States did in the 19th and early 20th centuries. In other cases, however, such as the settlement of Western Europeans in Eastern Europe during the Middle Ages, the migrants retained their own language and culture for centuries, and to some extent, assimilated members of the indigenous population to the transplanted cultures. This was especially so when the transplanted peoples were more prosperous, more highly skilled, and better educated. Peoples who may be very poor in their native lands can sometimes prosper in some other lands which have more promising geographic or other advantages that the migrants have the human capital to benefit from, often more so than indigenous inhabitants. For generations, it was a paradox that the Chinese and the Indians prospered almost everywhere around the world, except in China and India. As late as 1994, 57 million overseas Chinese produced as much wealth as the 1 billion Chinese in China. However, major economic reforms in China and India, beginning in the late 20th century, brought much higher economic growth rates in both countries, suggesting that their domestic populations, as well as their overseas offshoots, had potentialities that required only a better setting in which to reach fruition. Imperialism. Conquests have transferred wealth, as well as cultures, among nations and peoples. During the height of the Spanish Empire, more than 200 tons of gold were shipped from the Western Hemisphere to Spain, and more than 18,000 tons of silver. King Leopold of Belgium likewise took vast riches from the Belgian Congo. In both cases, and others, imperial powers extracted huge amounts of wealth from some conquered peoples, often through the forced labor of those peoples. As John Stuart Mill put it, conquerors have often treated the conquered peoples as mere dirt under their feet. This was true not only of European conquests in the Western Hemisphere, Africa, and Asia, it was equally true of indigenous conquerors of other indigenous peoples in all those places, and of Asian, Middle Eastern, and North African conquerors who invaded Europe in the centuries preceding Europeans' invasions of other lands. From a purely economic standpoint, putting aside the painful implications of such behavior for human nature in general, the question is, how much do these conquests and enslavements of the past explain economic disparities among nations and peoples in the present? There is no question that during the centuries when Spain was the leading conqueror in the world, it destroyed whole civilizations, such as those of the Incas and the Mayans, and impoverished whole peoples in the process of enriching itself. Spain's empire in the Western Hemisphere extended continuously from the southern tip of South America all the way up to the San Francisco Bay, and also included Florida, among other places, while there were also parts of Europe ruled by Spain, and in Asia, the Philippines. But there is also no question that Spain is today one of the poorer countries in Western Europe. Meanwhile, European countries that have never had empires, such as Switzerland and Norway, have higher standards of living than Spain. While the vast wealth that poured into Spain from its colonies could have been invested in building up the commerce and industry of the country and building up the literacy and occupational skills of its people, this wealth was in fact largely dissipated in the consumption of imported luxuries and military adventures during the Golden Age of Spain in the 16th century. Both luxuries and war were primarily for the benefit of the ruling elite, rather than for the advancement of the Spanish people at large. As late as 1900, more than half the population of Spain remained illiterate. By contrast, in the United States that same year, a majority of the black population could read and write, despite having been free for less than 50 years. A century later, the real per capita income in Spain was slightly lower than the real per capita income of black Americans. Like many conquering peoples, the Spaniards in their golden age disdained commerce, industry, and labor, and their elites reveled in leisurely and luxurious living. This led to a large and continuous drain of precious metals from Spain to other countries to pay for imports. Silver could thus become in short supply within Spain just weeks after the arrival of ships laden with silver from its Western Hemisphere colonies. The Spaniards themselves spoke of gold as pouring down on Spain like rain on a roof, flowing on away immediately. Nor were Spaniards unique among great conquering peoples in having little to show economically in later centuries for their earlier historic conquests and exploitations of other peoples. The descendants of Genghis Khan's vast conquering hordes in Central Asia are today among the poorer peoples of the world. So are the many peoples in the Middle East, who were once part of a triumphant Ottoman Empire that ruled conquered lands in Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East. Nor have the descendants of the peoples of the Mughal Empire or the Russian Empire been particularly prosperous. Britain might seem to be an exception, in that it once had the largest empire of all, encompassing one-fourth of the land area of the earth and one-fourth of the human race, and today has a high standard of living. However, it is questionable whether the British Empire had a net profit over the relatively brief span of history in which it was at its ascendancy. Individual Britons such as Cecil Rhodes grew rich in the empire, but the British taxpayers bore the heavy costs of conquering and maintaining the empire, including the world's largest burden of military expenditures per capita. Britain also had at one time the world's largest slave trade in its empire. But even if all the profits from slavery had been invested in British industry, this would have amounted to less than 2% of Britain's domestic investments during that era. The economic record of slavery in general as a source of lasting economic development is unimpressive. Slavery was concentrated in the southern part of the United States and in the northern part of Brazil, and in both cases, these remained the less prosperous and less technologically advanced regions of these countries. Similarly, in Europe, where slavery persisted in Eastern Europe long after it had died out in Western Europe, the latter being for centuries the faster-growing and more prosperous part of the continent right up to the present day. Slavery continued to exist in the Middle East and in parts of sub-Saharan Africa long after it was banished from the rest of the world, but the Middle East and sub-Saharan Africa are today places noted more for poverty than for economic achievements. In short, forcible transfers of wealth from some nations or peoples to other nations or peoples, whether through conquest or enslavement, can be large without producing lasting economic development. A vast amount of human suffering may produce little more than the transient enrichment of contemporary elites, who live in luxury and invest little or nothing for the benefit of future generations. What was said of serfdom in Russia, that it simply put much wealth in the hands of a spendthrift nobility, would apply to other systems of oppression elsewhere that contributed little or nothing to economic development. By and large, imperialism cannot be said unequivocally to have been a net economic benefit or a net economic loss to those who were conquered. In some cases, it was clearly one rather than the other. But even where there were long-run benefits to the descendants of the conquered peoples, as in Western European nations conquered by the Romans, the generations that were conquered and lived under Roman oppression were by no means necessarily better off. However, even such a British patriot as Winston Churchill said, "We owe London to Rome, because the ancient Britons created nothing comparable themselves." Yet the sufferings and humiliations inflicted on the ancient Britons provoked a mass uprising that was put down by the Romans with a merciless slaughter of thousands. What can be said from an economic standpoint is that there is little compelling evidence that current economic disparities between nations in income and wealth can be explained by a history of imperial exploitation. There were usually large economic or other disparities before these conquests, and these pre-existing disparities facilitated worldwide conquests by relatively modest-sized nations like Spain and Britain, each of which conquered vastly larger lands and populations than their own. Implications. Trying to assign relative weights to the various factors behind economic differences would be an ambitious and hazardous undertaking. Even a sketch of just some of the individual factors involved in economic advancement suggests that equal economic outcomes for different regions, races, nations, or civilizations have been unlikely in principle and rare empirically. When the various interactions of these factors are considered, the chances of equal outcomes become even more remote, as the number of combinations and permutations increase exponentially. For example, regions with similar rivers are unlikely to have similar economic outcomes if the lands through which the rivers flow are different, or the cultures of the people living on those lands are different, or the waterways into which the rivers empty are different in proximity to markets or in other ways. Interactions are crucial. Despite the importance of geographic settings in limiting or extending opportunities for economic development, there can be no geographic determinism, since it is the interactions of the physical world with changing human knowledge and varied human cultures which help determine economic outcomes. Most of the substances found in nature that are natural resources for us today were not natural resources for the caveman, because human knowledge had not yet reached the level required to use those substances for human purposes. Only as the frontiers of knowledge advanced did more and more substances become natural resources in unpredictable times and places, changing the relative geographic advantages and disadvantages of different regions. Even when geography is unchanging, its economic consequences are not. Nevertheless, the effect of geographic influences can be considerable in a sequence of events involving many other factors. Peoples isolated geographically for centuries, whether in the Balkan Mountains or in the rift valleys of Africa, tend to be culturally fragmented as well. They may also tend to have highly localized loyalties, tribalism, or Balkanization, that make it more difficult for them to combine with others to form larger political units like nation-states. In turn, their individually small societies may for centuries be vulnerable to marauding enslavers or imperial conquerors. Nor do cultures which originated in places that were geographically isolated for centuries quickly vanish when modern transportation and communications penetrate that isolation. Some people define environment as the physical, geographic, or socioeconomic surroundings as of a given time and place. But this leaves out the cultural patterns inherited from the past, which can differ greatly among groups who are all currently living in the same setting with the same opportunities, but leading to very different economic outcomes among these groups. Although the children of Italian and Jewish immigrants to the United States in the early 20th century lived in very similar surroundings and often attended the same neighborhood schools, they came from cultures that put very different emphasis on education, and these children performed very differently in school, leading to different economic patterns as adults. Even the relatively few individual factors sketched here show many complications when examined in greater detail, which is to say that the variables at work increase exponentially for each of these factors, making equal outcomes ever more unlikely. Even though the advent of agriculture was an epoch-making advance in the social evolution of the human species, opening up the possibility of larger and more complex societies than would have been possible for hunter-gatherers, the need for replenishing the soil nutrients used up by agriculture was by no means immediately obvious to the first farmers. But those farmers who happened to be located where rivers flooded the land annually, automatically replenishing the nutrients at a given location with nutrients washed down from other locations, prospered for reasons the farmers did not even need to understand. The agricultural methods available at that time made permanent settlement of relatively large populations impossible in most parts of the earth. Only in some river valleys where annual floods fertilized the fields could the land be farmed continuously over the years. These rare conditions were found in the valley of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in what is today Iraq. These created great economic inequalities between those fortunate enough to live in that part of the world at that time and most people in most other places, until farmers elsewhere realized the need for applying fertilizer to the land. This then made sedentary agriculture possible elsewhere, and this meant that sedentary societies, including cities, became possible around the world. Other factors not explored here, such as demographic differences among regions, races, nations, and civilizations, simply add to the complications and the inequalities. When the difference in median age between nations, or between racial or ethnic groups within a given nation, can be 10 or 20 years, the likelihood that different peoples would have even approximately equal economic outcomes, despite their many years' differences in adult economic experience, is reduced to the vanishing point. While there are discernible geographic, cultural, and other patterns behind many economic inequalities among peoples and nations, there are also sheer happenstances that can play major roles. Wise decisions or foolish mistakes made by those who happened to be political or military leaders of particular peoples at crucial junctures in history can determine the fate of nations, empires, and generations yet unborn. The decision of China's leaders, when that was the most advanced nation in the world, to seal off their country from the rest of the world, forfeited China's preeminence in the centuries that followed. The role of chance, when closely matched armies clash on chaotic battlefields, can make the difference between victory and defeat a near-run thing, as the Duke of Wellington said of the Battle of Waterloo, which he won against Napoleon, and which determined the fate of Europe for generations to come. Had the Battle of Tours in 732 or the Siege of Vienna in 1529 gone the other way, this could be culturally a very different world today, with very different economic patterns. Other happenstances include the great biological vulnerability of the indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere to the diseases brought by Europeans, which diseases often decimated the native populations more than the European weapons did. Because the Europeans were far less vulnerable to the diseases of the Western Hemisphere, the outcomes of many of the struggles between the two races were essentially predetermined by microorganisms that neither of these races knew existed at the time. It was said of a kindly Spanish priest who went among the native peoples in friendship as a missionary that he was probably responsible for more deaths among them than even the most brutal conquistador. Taking into account both discernible geographic, cultural, and other patterns that present either wide or narrow opportunities for different peoples in different places and times, unpredictable happenstances that can disrupt existing patterns of life or even change the course of history, suggests that neither equality of economic outcomes nor the indefinite persistence of a particular pattern of inequalities can be assumed. What the centuries ahead will be like, no one can know, but much may depend on how well the many peoples and their leaders around the world understand what factors promote economic growth and what factors impede it.